Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. From Columbia University comes a study published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology showing that the omega-3 fatty acids can help protect your brain from air pollution. Now, why is that important? Well, because millions of people throughout the world die each year because of air pollution, but air pollution is a contributing factor, in effect, a comorbidity for Corona-19. So the cleaner the air, that's just one less thing that you have to be concerned about. The more polluted the air, well, the more you have to be concerned. I'll give you the latest on that and how the omega-3 can help you with air pollution. We have about 12 good studies coming today on how to live a longer and healthier life and some really interesting new scientific reports on how to extend your aging process. Also today, I'm going to focus upon several issues. One is that they're accelerating the public relations campaign to prepare us for the inevitability of mandatory vaccine for the COVID virus. I'm very concerned because of the lack of real good science and the danger that represents based upon all the other vaccines that they've had the time to do it correctly and have not. So we'll be hearing from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. today about one vaccine in particular and why we should use that as an example. Now, mind you, that was an example of how they had the time and the resources to do it right, but then again, they had no downside if they did it wrong. So if they happen to create a vaccine that injures you, causes autism or death, so be it. They're not impacted. They don't have to pay anything back. How foolish is that? So we're going to take a look at that. Then we're going to have a clip from Dr. Andrew Wakefield re-examining how did the vaccine industry create a coup in 1986 to get President Reagan to sign an agreement that all vaccine manufacturers would be exempt from any liability. So he'll give us the new insights on that. And then I'm going to give you the latest on COVID. Should you wear a mask or not? There are arguments on both sides. I'll share both sides of the argument and my own opinion as well. Then we're finding out now that an awful lot of what we've been told about the COVID virus is simply inaccurate. And now what are the real facts? And therefore, what can we do in a cautionary and a principled way to protect ourselves or those who are more risk than we are if we're healthy. So we have a lot to share. Plus, I'm going to throw a few video clips in, including one aside from Bobby Kennedy and Andrew Wakefield, one from Professor Jonathan Haidt, The Coddling of the American Mind. This is a short video clip. He is on Bill Maher, but it's one of the most prescient because it shows you how did we get to where the notion of fragility from everything, being offended by everything, being angry by everything, being disconnected from any actual reality or responsible for making it a better world for anyone, for a whole generation. How did that happen? He gives one of the best insights I've ever heard. And then I'll open it up for you to call in and share your insights, because I'm sure everyone has had some experience. But on a spectrum, we benefit when we hear a lot of different input from different people from different backgrounds. I think it's very important. The more diversity of ideas that we have on a subject, the broader is our perspective in a different context. So that's why we encourage people, whether I agree or disagree is irrelevant. Whether you agree or disagree in part or whole is irrelevant. Because if you disagree, you just discard it. Ask yourself, why do I just disagree with this? And I do the same thing. When I'm listening to someone, I can disagree with what they're saying, but it doesn't mean I shut that door. Because they may say something else that I would agree with. I think we're at that example of yes, no, right, wrong, black, white, on everything. We become way too polarized. Everything seems to be weaponized. And that's not good for any of us. So we're going to hear that discussion. So we have a lot to share with you. It begins with the latest on health and healing. Research reported just this week, it's finished, shows that when you're taking the omega-3 fatty acids, you're actually protecting yourself, protecting your brain, caused by the fine particulate matter in the air. Now, you can get either the fish-based omega-3 fatty acids, or you can get the vegan-based omega-3 fatty acids when you eat an avocado, when you have a handful of walnuts, when you're eating some flaxseed in your smoothie. Those are all good sources, the omega-3 fatty acids. But what's important is that you want to protect your brain from any form of neurotoxin, like lead or mercury. But we forget that in the air are all these neurotoxins, and we're breathing in these very fine particulate matter, and that comes from air pollution. Now, when you're in Los Angeles, when you're in Denver, wow, you see it. It's thick as mud. But when you're in other cities, you generally don't see it. And there are places in the United States that are far more polluted than others. If you're around an industry, you see it. Interesting, because when we were filming a new film that will be out in about 7 months, I got two new films coming out in the next 12 months. One finally is Manufacturing Madness. Another is a completely new drugging of our children, because I'm looking at how vulnerable our children are from many different perspectives today. And also the new one, Last Call for Tomorrow. That's the new multi-award winning. I mean, we just won the, we're just nominated to be in the Cannes International Independent Film Festival, and which is a big honor. I think we had five last week and two today. So it's an environmental film like no other environmental film. And the moment theaters open in New York where it's safe, I will come back into New York and I will have a premiere and a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI. In any case, I was doing a new film following up Poverty, Inc., and it's called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? It's the new poverty. Now imagine, I thought I was almost finished filming before COVID. Whoa, that whole together changed how I'm looking at poverty today. And by just, I was having a conversation yesterday. Everywhere you look, foods are not available. I'm going to buy some cases of baked beans, not available, from the largest distributor in the health food market. Don't have any. But then I listed all the other things they don't have. Do you remember about 4 months ago, I said what you're going to have is people are going to be either hoarding, or major big companies like Walmart and Costco, Whole Foods, are going to be buying huge amounts, and they're going to run out. Because unlike making masks, that they can make 10 million, 50 million without a problem, all they have to do is tool up and do it. You can't just go out there and grow beans. It takes months. You can't grow a head of lettuce overnight. And so there's going to be a period of time when we're out. And then when we get it in, the largest manufacturers will work with the largest retailers, and smaller stores are going to go out of business. I predict that half, 50% of all health food stores will go bankrupt in the next 6 months. I predict that 40% of all closed businesses in New York and all of its boroughs will not reopen. I predict that 11% of those that do reopen will be bankrupt in 90 days. And because of how foolishly all this is being handled. In any case, here's what I also predict. So listen carefully what I'm going to say to you. And there's good science to back this up. With the next wave of COVID coming, probably in the fall, when seasonal changes in temperature, people starting to use indoor heating, not even thinking about all the vents that contain bacteria which reduce our immune system, and people being not properly supplemented, we're going to take a hit, as we do every year, unless you're smart and prevent this, with your immune system, therefore making people wouldn't manifest symptoms of COVID manifest them. It's particularly hard on senior citizens who are not out in the sun enough as it is, don't have enough vitamin D and exercise, etc. So then they're going to be hoarding again of food. You're going to see a massive amount of food shortages. Now, That's bad. That's nothing compared to what you're going to see starting this year in the United States and around the world due to global warming. You're seeing things with the global warming that we have never seen in history before, not in human history before. You're seeing the great tundras, the boreal forest in the northern latitudes. You're seeing the Arctic in areas like Greenland and Iceland and Alaska with major forest fires. You're seeing whole areas that are warming at such a high temperature that you're going to have fires. In fact, just in the New York Times, just last week, quote, intense Arctic wildfires set a pollution record. High temperatures and dry soil mean ideal conditions for fires. Blazes in June produce more carbon emissions than any other fires in almost two decades of monitoring. Okay, that's just one. Plus, we had the hottest day in the Arctic Circle, above the Arctic Circle, actually, 100 degrees above the Arctic Circle. That's the kind of temperature you would expect in southern Florida or southern Texas. No, this is the Arctic Circle. That means that all that frozen solid for thousands of years, the permafrost, is thawing. And it thaws, you go to walk on it, you walk right up, your whole leg will sink right down to your hip. It can go down 20, 30, 40 feet, and that catches on fire. There's no way to put that fire out. It can burn for decades and releasing more carbon, but just the methane releases more carbon. That increases global warming. That increases more melting. That increases global warming. And there you've got your positive feedback loop. So it's coming down across Canada into the northern states, including our northern breadbasket states. People forget that grains are grown in Montana, lots in Wyoming, South Dakota, and then you get into your breadbasket states, Kansas, Colorado, Indiana, Illinois, southern Illinois, Arkansas, big time, Nebraska, big time, Texas, and of course all of California. The soil heats up. Now, it may not bother you, a 3 to 5 degree temperature, so instead of 80, it's 85. Not a big deal. You go into where it's air conditioned or you enjoy the outdoors. Soil doesn't work that way. It changes the microorganism and the composition of the soil. It makes it very difficult for seeds to grow, to germinate. They frequently die. And so just a slight temperature variation can cause massive amounts of seeds not germinating. That's why sometimes with seeds, instead of putting one seed in, you have to put three in, or even five in, five seeds to get one to grow. And then on top of that, we're going to have, and do now, more rain, massive amounts of rain coming down at one time in the same areas. So the areas that are drought-stricken are now in a historical drought, and those that are water-plagued will have more water. Well, if you're a planting state like Nebraska and Arkansas, you have so much water this year, this past summer and fall, that your crops rotted, your seeds rotted. And then by the time you could go back in the spring of this past year and replant, it's too late. Right now, if you start to plant in the middle of July, if you start to plant in many states, by the time that product is ready to harvest, you've already got hit with a frost in the fall. So you've got the worst of all combinations. So now is not the time to be a farmer, and yet farmers are going out of business. And because the worldwide food market is plentiful at different times, South Africa has its summer when we have our winter and vice versa. So they'll grow cherries, and Argentina will grow peaches, nectarines, and plums. So you'll be able to get food, but it's going to be very costly. And of course, the wealthy don't have to worry about that. But what about the average person who is food insecure? What about the, now it went from 16 to 18 million children are food insecure. They simply don't have enough food to eat. Now, anyone who's a human being realizes that the most vulnerable to all this are children. How do you explain to a child that they have to go to bed hungry because there's not enough food? Why isn't that? No one's marching. No one's protesting. Is that not important? Of course it's important. That's what happens when we put all of our energy in one area and none in all the other areas that are also important, including to our very survival. I told y'all over 6 months ago, be very careful. Greta Thunberg was correct in what she said. Everything else was a dog and pony show. Everything else. And we proved it. We went behind the scenes. We investigated her parents and everyone else associated. It was just like Al Gore. It's just a total smoke and mirrors. Yeah, we want, you know, to deal with global warming and you own a gigantic hedge fund that invests in green energy, so you want people going into your green. It's all so stupid. But did anything change? Did all those millions and millions of young people who got out on Fridays to protest, did they go vegan? No. Did they stop buying clothes made in Bangladesh, causing women to be abused in their how they were treated? No. So did anything good come from that? No, except some people became very famous and very wealthy, and other people, everything went right back to the way it was. But with the environment, it's not the way it was. It's getting worse. So mark my words, we're going to start seeing food shortages in the United States. And then what about the countries that depend upon the United States to get them their grains? So the number one issue for most Americans starting now going forward is going to be food and water. We're running out of water. The Agalaga water aquifer, the largest in the United States, is going way down below where it can be repercolated, recharged. Too many people use it for too long without any thought. So those who are smart, get into growing your own food and storing it, either freeze-drying or drying, and then have your own capacity to have food, because you'll see what I mean come January. And when people are going to be out of an awful lot of things, that doesn't mean that we're going to be out of everything. It means an awful lot of things, and it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. There is no happy ending to this. I'm just giving you a heads up because I study this with a great deal of scholarship. I get trends all over the world every day, and I look at them and I say, well, this is where we're going because no one's paying attention to global warming. And you better, because we're going to be affected by it. In any case, I just wanted to share that as an aside. Now, to finish my thought. So when we're filming, going in different parts of the country with air pollution, you go down a highway, you go down all through Arkansas, down through Alabama, you can go into Mississippi or Louisiana. You'll see these what are called cancer alleys. Might be 200, 300 miles. On one side of a road, you have major factories. On the other side of the road, you have lines of houses where people live. On one side, you have multi-billion-dollar companies. And on the other side, you have people with cancer and other diseases that are not normal, that can be shown from the pollutants in the air. When you ask the people, why won't you move? And you'll see in the film, we're talking with people, why are you staying here? Well, my sister's got cancer, my brother's got cancer, and everybody's got cancer. You know, you just accept that, you know, this is what comes when you got to work, you know, at one of these plants, and they're poor. So shouldn't we have a resettlement program where the government, we the people, care enough about these poor souls that we find a place that has clean air, and we help build, so they don't have the money to do it, so we do something good. We build livable housing where people can be moved to so they can prevent their health from deteriorating. Again, if you live in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago, Miami, you're not going to see any of this. You see, we don't see most of America. We don't see the people there. We don't hear their complaints. We don't hear their we don't know what they're living through. We only know our own lives. Boy, you have to see all this, state after state after state. We're talking about millions of people living in dire poverty and no way out. That's why I believe that we have to make these issues important, because the Democrats have caused the problem, the Republicans have caused the problems. There are individuals within Congress who know better, but as groups, they're all corrupt. They'll serve the interests of special interest groups, but not the public. It's just one example. In any case, the omega-3 fatty acids can help if you're in an area where you have air particulate, because it can damage your brain because they're neurotoxic. Now, from Bowman University's and Cross River University, they found that kidney disease can be helped with virgin coconut oil. That's good. It can protect your kidneys from the damaging effects of diabetes. That's according to the research published in Folia Medica. So remember, when you have high blood glucose, meaning high blood sugar, you're damaging your kidneys. Diabetes mellitus, or also called just diabetes, or when I was growing up, sugar diabetes, can lead to major complications, especially the kidneys. About a quarter of people with diabetes develop diabetic neuropathy or diabetic kidney disease. And now you might have high blood pressure or poor blood pressure control, an increased need to urinate, a shortness of breath, gastrointestinal complications. Those are some of the symptoms. And left untreated, the disease can lead to a decreased kidney function or even total kidney failure, causing unsafe amounts of toxins and harmful substances to accumulate in the blood. So something that can help is extra virgin coconut oil. So those of you who've been taking it all along without even being aware of it, you're helping your kidneys. Also, from University of Massachusetts comes a study published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Prevention Research that frying oil, you know, the kind of oil you see in restaurants and fast food, place where you get your French fries fried, or you get fried chicken, they fry everything now. Well, it worsens colon cancer and colitis in this study. So first of all, you shouldn't be eating anything in fried oil. If you want anything, you can use a food dehydrator. You put it on 120 degrees and you can make your own gluten-free pizza crust. You can dry things that still are functionally raw because they haven't been heated up and cooked. And you're not using canola and corn and palm oils. You're using healthy oils. So you can treat yourself to things that you're used to, but you can do it in a vegan, healthy, organic way. All right, that's what it's showing, because you can end up eating all that soggy food.
Setting up a generation for failure, Jonathan Haidt. Let's get right to this and see how this all folds in together. Now, the last thing we need in this country is another reason for democracy to be threatened. But your book says we have one. It's the darn kids today. Explain that a little. I'm paraphrasing. You're an actual eminent professor. You say it in better words than I just did, please.
Sure. Well, the book has its origins in an observation from my co-author, Greg Lukianoff. He is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, defends free speech rights on campus. And in 2013, Greg began noticing that for the first time, it was the students who were asking for protections from words and books and ideas and speakers. Previously, students had protested speakers before, but they'd never before medicalized it. They acted as though if this person says something, I will be harmed, damaged, people will be traumatized. And so this was something new. And when they put it in terms of safety, well, then administrators have to respond. So this came in around 2013, 2014, and it brought with it a whole package of innovations, you might say, microaggression training, safe spaces, trigger warnings. All this stuff appears from out of nowhere around 2013, 2014.
That's something I did not realize until I was reading your book. I thought it went back further because I've been talking about the fragile stuff for a long time, but I didn't realize that this is a new generation. The millennials stop at 1995?
1994, that's right.
Okay, so now we're into the iGen, you call them, or Generation Z?
Right, same thing, that's right.
And they're even more fragile.
Yeah, well, so this is something that...
Who can we blame? Let's start blaming. I want to blame. Let's play the blame game.
Okay.
I say
well,
parents.
Let's see.
You go.
Okay. We'll do all the parents and we'll do all the teachers. So yeah, the basic finding, which I think surprised a lot of us assumed that the millennials were from 1982 to around 2000 or 1998. But kids born around 1995 had a very different childhood from kids born a few years before. And so research by Gene on their devices, talking with each other. And this seems to be changing social development. And we know this. This is not just some, you know, perception from outsiders, because the rates of anxiety disorders, depression, self-cutting, where they have to be admitted to hospitals, and suicide, all of these rates are way, way up, especially for girls, and it all begins right around 2011. And so it's when this generation first enters college campuses, and 2013... that's when this new attitude about speech comes in.
Isn't another reason that they're sitting home instead of doing all those fun things is because the parents insist on watching them all the time.
Exactly.
I remember 20 years ago, we talked about helicopter parents, you know, hovering over them. And now they call it bulldozer parenting.
Yep.
They clear out any obstacles in the
concierge
way.
Concierge parenting, I've heard.
Right. Yeah. So that the kid doesn't have to ever face any difficulties. How can that kid function in the real world?
That's right. So the most important psychological idea in the book is anti-fragility, that there are some things that are fragile, like a wine glass. If you knock it over, it breaks. Nothing good happens. If something is plastic, you knock it over, it doesn't get damaged, but it doesn't get better. But there are some things that have to be stressed or challenged, like the immune system. If you protect your kid's immune system, use bacterial wipes, you're actually hurting the kid. You're preventing the system from getting the information it needs. Same thing with social life. If you protect your kids from being excluded, from being insulted, from being teased, when they grow up, it's like the princess and the pea, a little tiny thing that they encounter on campus now becomes intolerably painful.
But it's not all over the country, really, is it? I mean, this is something when they talk about elites, this is who we're talking about, I think, a little more than the heartland.
Well,
you know,
the
kids who are... you, Mom. You know, I call them the fuck you, Mom generation.
Now,
I
mean, it was, New York, too.
Yeah. I mean, calling Mom a bitch, turning their back on when their mother's talking. If I did that, I would not be sitting here today. The constant negotiating with the kids, you know. Hey, buddy.
Yeah.
Ready to go?
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Kids need structure and authority, and when parents try too hard to be their friends. Yeah. But on the point about whether this is everywhere, so this is such a new trend. We only began to notice these things in the last couple of years. But what seems to be the case is that the anxiety and depression, the fragility, the mental illness, that's across the country, across social classes, across races. And that's why social media use is beginning in middle school. That seems to be the most likely culprit of several culprits. So that's all over the country. But the shout-downs, the screaming at professors, we've mapped that out. That is almost only in the Northeast and just the coastal strip of the West Coast and a little bit in Chicago.
But that's what gets the headlines, and that's what dominates media. It's the kid who's screaming at the professor who then gets a job at the Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And provides fodder for right-wing media to say, look how terrible
And the problem with liberals in general is that they let those kids who are at the Huffington Post or whatever writing their insane woke shit, they let them control the debate, just like the parents let the kid control when we're leaving.
Yeah.
We've let the kids take over. That's like job one don't do in civilizations.
No, that's right.
You respect the elders. That's like every civilization before this one, because they might be wiser. But to connect it to this point of why we lose, I think that's relevant. I think people in this country don't anymore pay attention to policy so much. It's more this personal stuff. It's anecdotal. I don't know about global warming or what causes a recession. But, you know, I saw that mother at the soccer game or in the supermarket, and her five-year-old was screaming at her, and she was apologizing to the five-year-old. I'm not going to let those people take over the country. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the level it works on.
And to give Donald Trump his due, I think he understands that because he's a guy who thinks that global warming is a Chinese hoax, but he knows how to attach derogatory nicknames to people, and that's a lot of his success in politics.
Yes.
The sanitization of the social media sites, you know, you have a kid puts beautiful pictures of themselves on the site, and then another kid looks at it and feels that their life is less than that beautiful sanitization. Is that affecting them as well and creating a lot of this anxiety?
Absolutely. And that's probably the main reason why it's affecting the girls so much more than the boys. Because if you imagine, you know, all of the kids in America around 2007 to 2009, and you suddenly just drop millions and millions of iPhones all over the country and kids pick them up, what are the boys going to do? Oh, video games. And it turns out, actually, video games aren't that harmful. Especially,
and porn.
Well,
no, really. And that's not a joke.
Yeah, motorboating.
Oh, Doc.
But just to finish up here, so the boys are mostly doing video games, which aren't so bad. Even if they're running around imaginary worlds killing people, as my son does with his friends, it's really cooperative. There's teamwork. They're talking. But what the girls are doing... What the girls are doing is putting something out and then waiting anxiously while people comment on it. Right. And so it's the social comparison, it's the fear of missing out. Also, girls' bullying is relational, boys' bullying is physical, so social media doesn't really affect it. But girls can never get away if they're being bullied. So this is why we think the suicide rate is up 25% for boys, but it's up 70% for girls.
Okay. And remember, there was no suicide that I saw. I'm sure many of you had no suicide. Now the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. Now we're going to a clip from Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and let's just put this in proper perspective. It was back in the early 2000s that Dr. Wakefield, along with a large group of specialists, mainly gastroenterologists, including one of the world's leading gastroenterologists, were studying a small group, I think around 12 children in Great Britain, who were diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, but they were looking at their mitochondria, the energy factories in their intestine. And they wrote an article, and in the article they didn't say that the MMR vaccine caused autism. They were saying it required more research, and it was published in The Lancet, and boy, were they excoriated. There was a whole campaign to attack them, especially Andrew Wakefield and the head scientist. And after years of being denounced by Anderson Cooper and Dr. Gupta and others as frauds and all kinds of bad names, they lost their medical licenses. However, the doctor went back and he went to the highest court in Great Britain. All the evidence was laid out and it was shown that they were extremely biased, they were inaccurate, and his license was fully restored and his reputation restored. That meant that everyone who had attacked Andrew Wakefield was wrong, but they've never apologized. And then we find out that Dr. William Thompson, the scientist at the CDC, who confessed, and we've heard his confession. Many of you, you've heard his confession. If you've watched Deadly Deception, my latest vaccine documentary, you hear him in his own words talking about how they lied. The MMR vaccine, back at the same time that they were doing their study with Andrew Wakefield in Great Britain, he was doing it, and the CDC found it increased autism in African-American boys 36 months and younger by almost 324%. Well, they couldn't have that. They said it was non-toxic, not related to autism, but it was. They covered it up, and therefore a massive cover-up. They put at least 100,000 young African-American boys at risk of developing autism or other conditions. This is Andrew Wakefield talking about how did they get to where they were indemnified, made harmless, no matter what vaccine they created, and how deadly they were. And this is where we have to begin our campaign, that is lobbying Congress to say, take back the indemnification, hold vaccine manufacturers responsible. But since the CDC and the U.S. Public Health Service also owns the majority of those patents, then they should also be held accountable. Now to Andrew Wakefield.
First question, obvious question, 1986, the Act, why the name?
Why the name? Well, it was clearly a play on George Orwell's 1984. He just got it wrong by 2 years, which is fairly remarkable. But the Act was, as you know, the Act we refer to is the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, signed into law by Ronald Reagan, which started the process of removing liability for vaccine injury from the manufacturers and the vaccine makers. And it really is at the heart of all of the problems that we see globally with vaccination now. That's a big call, but it's true. Why? Because it made the vaccine manufacturers so wealthy, so powerful, that they could buy anything they wanted. They bought the media, they bought the politicians worldwide, they bought doctors, they wrote policy, they put themselves in charge. And they have become so extraordinarily powerful. And the fascinating thing, Sasha, is that we finished production on this film in November. We finished filming the actors in November. We knew nothing, we'd never heard of COVID-19. But the film could not be more relevant to the circumstances in which we find ourselves globally right now. And what people need to do is to understand where we came from. Because if they understand where we came from, they understand the implications of where we are being driven right now with this notion that every man, woman, and child on the planet is going to have a mandatory vaccination at the behest of Bill Gates and his entourage. And unless people understand how disastrously wrong that has gone in the past, whenever it's been done, and liability being taken away from the manufacturers for any damage done, then people will not appreciate the true nature of the dilemma that we currently face.
Indeed. And it, just to put this into context, you've already had some success, I believe, with Del Bigtree and Robert Kennedy Jr. in the courts. What's the parallel there with the success that you've had? How does that relay into today with COVID and with impending mandatory vaccinations?
Well, I think that is very much, you know, that's something they've achieved, and that's fantastic. And Bobby is, as you know, pursuing that. And there is one, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, just to put it in context, did three things. It was meant to give a degree of liability protection to the industry, but not for vaccines that could be safer. There was still an obligation on the industry to produce safer vaccines. It was meant to compensate children who'd been damaged, and it was meant to make vaccines safer by doing the right research. Now, in the first respect, it succeeded enormously. In the latter two respects, it's been a dismal failure. But there is one circumstance which circumvents the Act, and that is if the industry has committed fraud, if it has misrepresented its facts in getting the vaccines licensed and onto the market to the regulators and has committed scientific fraud, in effect. What this film shows is exactly that. It unearths and exposes for the first time the, not just the fraud, but the extraordinary extent of that fraud that led up to Congress being blackmailed into passing the Act in the first place. You see, what they were told, what Congress were told, what the doctors were told, what the public were told, is that we, the industry, the makers of, in this case, the pertussis, the whooping cough vaccine, have made this as safe as we possibly can. We've done everything we can to make it safer. You want people to have this vaccine, kids to have this vaccine. We're not making a lot of money on it, but we're getting sued. So either you give us indemnity, we're going to stop making the vaccine, and kids are going to die, and it's your fault. How do you feel about that? That was the sort of under the subtext of what was going on. That was a lie. And what this documentary exposes is, for the first time ever, discovery documents, legal discovery documents, which showed that the industry had a patent, for example, just one document, patent for a safer pertussis vaccine in 1937. The vaccine wasn't licensed until the 80s. The vaccine wasn't licensed until after 60 years after they had a patent for a safer vaccine, but it was going to cost them more to make it, pennies on the dollar, so they buried it. They didn't do anything with it because it was safer, sorry, it was cheaper, it was more profitable for them to injure children, kill children with this unsafe vaccine and just put it down to a business expense. And that's what they did. And they lied to Congress saying they couldn't make it safer when all along they could. So this is just one of a succession of exposés in the film that have never come to light. But they haven't come to light because these cases were settled before the act came into being. These cases were settled on the court steps because the industry knew they could not face the scrutiny of a jury. If they'd gone before a jury and all of this information had been exposed, they would have been bankrupted. And that's the real reason. And so that really is the essence of the first part of the film. And the second part is the consequences of taking away liability.
Your opinion, your thoughts, what has gone wrong that we allow this to happen and we're not challenging it? What you don't challenge becomes the new norm, like accepting that everything we're told out of Washington, either the White House that you don't trust or Anthony Fauci that you do trust, and neither one should be trusted. And then one day they say, well, we have the vaccine. Everybody says, oh, good, I'll get in line for it. Before you do that, I want to share some things with you that I think are very important. And if we understand what we're not being told, then we have a more complete picture. For example, a highly respected group of scientists, a consortium of unbiased Swiss physicians and scientists got together. Here's the latest information. According to the latest immunological and serological studies, the overall lethality of COVID-19 is about 0.1% maximum, and thus is in the range of a strong seasonal influenza. In countries like the U.S. and United Kingdom, and also Sweden, without a lockdown, overall mortality since the beginning of the year is in the range of a strong influenza season. In countries like Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, overall mortality is in the range of a mild influenza season. Even in a global hotspot, the risk of death from the general population of school and working age is typically in the range of a daily car ride to work. Yeah, that's how many people get killed. That's how many people are dying. So you have to look at the overall death rate. So if the overall death rate in countries has not changed, then it is a manipulation. And a lot of the statistics have been wrong. We see how many people who didn't die from the COVID but may have had the COVID, and it was listed not the comorbidities, heart disease, emphysema, but the COVID. That's stacking the figures. Up to 80% of all test positive persons remain symptom free. Even among 70 to 79 year olds, almost 60% remain symptom free. Over 95% of all persons developed at most moderate symptoms. Then why aren't we being told this? Why do they keep emphasizing more people are infected, more people infected? It's much easier to infect a person with COVID than many other types of viruses, but it's far less lethal. So if you overly treat them with overly aggressive drugs that were not known to help the person in the first place, instead of looking for the drugs that they're not recommending, which were FDA approved, which are helping them, that would have changed that scenario. And also, the median age of the deceased in most countries, including Italy, is over 80 years of age. 86 years of age, the average death rate of COVID patients in Sweden, and only about 4% of the deceased had no serious preconditions, which means 96% of the people who died had comorbidities. The age and risk profile of deaths thus essentially corresponds to normal mortality. And in many countries, up to 2/3 of all extra deaths occurred in nursing homes, which do not benefit from a general lockdown. But you shouldn't have anyone who has COVID in a nursing home or assisted living center hospice. That's why you should be giving them a different type of protocol. Mind you, it's been decades. No new protocols in any of the nursing homes or the critical care facilities. And they're not even getting adequate nutrition or even hydration. People actually die of dehydration, die of malnutrition in nursing homes. They keep them sedated all day. And instead of doing something holistic, they could give them a quality of life, if not extend their life substantially. And and even in so-called COVID-19 deaths, it is often not clear whether they died from or with coronavirus because the studies were not done. Now, that's just some, that's eight of almost 30 points that they made. But there's also some new information on the testing, and that shows how inaccurate the testing is, the false negatives and false positives with the existing tests. So why would you be saying that someone has or does not have COVID infection based upon a test that itself is so grossly inaccurate? Because then you can end up with what's coming next. And this is something really concerns me. They're starting in Africa with this, and they're going to be giving everyone a particular type of card, and that card will show your whole history of being inoculated and tested. And that is sponsored by the Bill Gates Foundation and a major credit card company. Does not look good, because once you're in that data system, they have a lot of control over whether you're able to travel or not, and where you're able to go or not go. And then they can force people to be tested or force people to be vaccinated. And if not, if you refuse, then depending upon the state and the rules of the state, like New York State, if it goes the way it's planned to go, you wouldn't be able to get out of your home if you weren't tested and vaccinated. Now, as far as the masks go, there are arguments on both sides. Some will tell you, and I will go into it in depth on tomorrow's show, that there's no business wearing a mask, because the particulate matter of the virus is much smaller than what any of the filtration systems would be. So all these cloth masks are not going to prevent that from getting into your air passage. But I disagree with that. When I'm flying, I wear a 100 N100 mask, 99. And then on top of that, I use colloidal silver inside and outside. And then I also use an ionizer and wear gloves. And generally my baseball hat, and then when I get to where I'm going, I throw all that into a laundry, disinfect it, take a shower, disinfect it. Because I don't know what's in that. Under normal conditions, airplanes are very dangerous, but so are subways, so are buses, so are cars, because particulate matter can stay in the air for hours and land on surfaces. So I go the other way. My own assessment is that it is perfectly safe to say that masks provide some protection and is better than no masks. The recent argument about aerosol transmission is a bit of a red herring, because COVID is not passed only by aerosol, but by droplets as well. If someone was in a room and coughed or sneezed, and you didn't know it, you didn't see them, you wouldn't know that there's droplets, and that could contain their viruses, and you could pick it up by touching a phone or a computer, or even hands on a top of something, a surface. You wouldn't know that. So why not err on the side of caution? So obviously, filtration of an aerosol is important, but it has to be at a higher level. So if you're going to wear a mask, wear an N95 minimal, but a 99 ideally. Now, if you're outside and, you know, you're walking, running, biking, then I don't believe you need a mask. But if you're around people and you're not certain their health status, yeah, then I would say definitely go on the side of caution and wear one. During the past month, there have been many studies showing COVID transmission as airborne, and that was Texas A&M. Airborne transmission is the most virulent rather than surface transmission. And a review by McMaster's University in Toronto of 172 observational studies across 16 countries and 6 continents, none were randomized controlled, but confirmed human-to-human transmission. 1 meter, or 3 feet, was a threshold between high and low transmission. And studies also indicated that transmission was much higher indoors. And now, mind you, if you've been aware that you have no symptoms, though you could be asymptomatic, meaning you have the virus, generally the virus will be destroyed by the body within about 14 days. But it can be reinfected also. That's what we're finding. And the body does not produce long-term protective antibodies because it doesn't. And also, since we believe now that it was genetically engineered, and I'll get into that in some depth, there's a big danger there because how are they going to create a vaccine for a virus that mutates? So you take one vaccine that might last maybe 2 months if you're lucky, and then anywhere from 30 to 50%. Why 30 to 50% effective? Because they haven't done any studies to have any evidence that it can be longer than that. Otherwise, if it's below 30%, why in the world would anyone get a vaccine that you would have to get every couple of months? And it's experimental, new, genetically engineered vaccine. Do you really want an experimental, non-tested, proper vaccine in your body for something that for the vast majority, 99.7% of people, is not going to kill you? Well, that's your choice. Retroviruses such as COVID are only about 150 nanometers in size. They're so minute that they'll be inhaled with the aerosols when breathed through a mask. An average bacteria is about 1,000 nanometers. On the other hand, if the virus is found in droplets, such as released from a cough or a sneeze, a mask can filter that. So a mask provides only limited protection. To feel you are 100% protected is wishful thinking. It's not going to happen. The best thing there is just not be around other people that without masks, so at least you can protect yourself. It's no different than if someone coughed in, or sneezed in their the bend in their arm, right? Or into a hanky. That provides some protection, but not 100% protection. So you don't want to be close to someone when they're sneezing. You know, and then someone, do you ever see people cough or sneeze in their hands and rub their hands together like somehow that sanitized it? It did nothing. It just smeared it around. Now everything they touch, they're going to infect. So it just means we have to be conscious. From the Mayo Clinic, your typical surgical mask will only filter large particles, such as particulate matter in the air or toxic pollutants that are larger. Cloth masks are only capable of filtering particles in droplets, meaning from a cough or sneeze, so they're least effective. So I see 99% of people I've ever seen are just wearing these cloth masks. And now I believe it's a deception and a dangerous one. If you're going to wear a mask, wear a good mask, N95 to N99. That will protect you more than the cloth. Cloths, no, they're not protective. The N95 is more capable of filtering some smaller particles than surgical masks, but they must be properly sealed against the face for full benefit, which is still not 100% protection. And one study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that argued masks are not effective at all, or only a very little, has been retracted by the authors. The study was found to have flawed methodology. And that was a study that's been picked up and sent around arguing against masks. So a lot of you probably read that. So they didn't do their homework. And from a Cleveland Clinic article, quote, once droplets reach the air, cloth masks don't filter the air you breathe, like a respirator, so they do not prevent droplets from reaching your nose or mouth, end quote. Therefore, the CDC's recommendation for wearing cloth masks is not especially preventative. The World Health Organization is more accurate that face masks can only limit protection. But by spraying colloidal silver in your nose and mouth and what you do is you put some coconut oil, massage it into your hands, then as throughout the day, if you don't have gloves, you spray your hands and just keep spraying down surface areas, especially if there are other people. Now, if you're alone, you don't have to wear a mask. It's just you, right? If you're outside, you know, I'm not going to wear a mask if I'm outside running. You know, if I'm in a marathon, yeah. If I'm around a lot of other people, yes. But, you know, I know how long particles stay in the air, hang in the air. I know how long they stay on different surfaces, whether it's metal, wood, or cloth. So I simply do the best I can. Remember, there, if you're alone, you don't have the problem. If you're a senior citizen who is not healthy and you have comorbidities, those people should be wearing masks indoors. If they're around other people, if they're not around other people, they shouldn't wear a mask indoors. And yes, you are breathing back in some of the carbon dioxide you just expelled, but the type of mask most people would be wearing are going to let a lot of the carbon dioxide out, especially around the cheek area, and that's where a lot of these masks leak. That's why you have to have a mask that's tight. But it's what you do by taking vitamin D and vitamin C and zinc and astragalus and drinking green juices and having garlic and ginger, then you're able to build up your immune system. And a lot of these are antibacterial and antiviral. So if I'm having green tea, I'll put a quarter teaspoon of Manuka honey in it. Manuka honey has natural antibacterial and antiviral properties. I'll put a couple drops of colloidal silver in. I'll put a couple drops of wild oregano oil into a smoothie. You don't really taste it, but it's doing that extra that if anything got in, it's able to kill it. And then your strong immune system is what does the ultimate killing. And that's what we've seen. Otherwise, we would have 99.7% of all the people infected who've been infected would be in intensive care or dead. And we see just the opposite. That's why we should be paying attention to our immune system, which they're not doing at all. That shows you how it's been. Unfortunately, it has been corporatized. Who's got the next expensive drug? Who's got the next vaccine? Tomorrow I'll play Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s segment that is really interesting, and I'm going to go into the history of Orthodox medicine's constant attacks to destroy all alternative therapies. If you understand that story, then you understand how the worst organization out there to get any information from would be the AMA and Wikipedia and these other places that are protecting the status quo of Big Pharma. And you who've been challenging, looking for freedom of choice on these health issues, you've been on the right side of it all along. So stay on the right side of COVID virus by holding everything they say with healthy skepticism and then doing your homework. I'll be continuing to give you the real science on this on a regular basis. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.